This show is brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is April. Joining me in the studio is Anne. Hi, Anne.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I just had a lovely meal prepared by my NYU students, and everyone has spring fever. Everyone is ready for the semester to be over, for us all to get I'm ready for the summer. And right at the top of the show, I want to bring on our first guest. We have two guests today, but joining us via phone is author of the new book, Fed White and Blue, Finding America with My Fork, Simon Majumdar. Hi, Simon.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm great. I wanted to jump right to you because I so associate summer with traveling.
Absolutely. Well, I have to say I associate every point of the year with traveling because I'm on the road so much. But I know that people are beginning to thaw out. I was just in New York recently, and people are slowly beginning to thaw out after what has been a rather brutal winter and thinking about going on to other places and enjoying their spring and summer, and I don't blame them.
So you've written this incredible book that has taken you all over our country and your inherited country. And I want to ask you, one of the things that stood out, first of all, I want to tell the listeners, I have been laughing out loud on the subway reading this book. You are such an incredible storyteller, and I really, really love the tone of the book.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. That means a great deal. I like to tell stories and to share my experiences, and I hope I have a way of doing it. I think without seeming like too full of myself, which a lot of people accuse me when I'm on the Food Network.
Right. So you are a judge on Cutthroat Kitchen, and I have been a competitor on that very same show.
Oh, who judged you?
Antonia LaFaso.
Oh, she's much tougher than I am. I'm a pussycat compared to Antonia.
Now, I have to tell you, I have talked about my I signed a non-disclosure agreement with the Food Network, and I am allowed to acknowledge my participation. But I will say that I joke with my husband. I say, if Simon had been the judge, I think I totally would have won.
Well, I won't let you divulge anything, but it's a great show, and I love being part of it. But the main reason I love being part of it, apart from it's such good fun and people really enjoy it, is I get to watch Alton Brown at work every day when I'm doing it. And it's just, he is one of those people who's up there with Julia Child, I think, as one of the great educators of this country. And I just love being, watching him at work and play.
And you both have it all. It's like you're incredibly smart, you're incredibly articulate, and you're great performers. And that's a fairly rare combination of traits. I think most people can be two out of three, but to be all three things is really remarkable.
Well, we have fun doing it, and I hope that comes through to people. And just the same with the book, I had an extraordinary time, and people were so generous to me, letting me go around the country and share their food experiences, which is what it was about, that I feel very, very lucky. And I certainly don't take it for granted, and I don't take for granted, my participation in the Food Network.
The stories that you tell, I would say you were very, very humble in them and very, very self-deprecating and very funny. And I will say one of the things that stood out to me is your obvious love of your wife. And I have to say, as a public facing spouse, I have a very supportive husband also behind me. Tell me about how wonderful your wife is.
Well, I probably can't tell you enough, because she is. She genuinely is my rock. And she's in the next room as we're speaking now, organizing the great Fed White and Blue book tour, which is very much like the book. It's a very, we're calling it that laughingly, as we're just us in a car with some books in the back of my knife roll, and we're traveling around the country having people invite us to stay with them and cook for them. And we're going all over the country and just going to, community centers and churches and hotels and bookstores and culinary schools, whatever it is, and just having and hanging out and cooking and sharing our experiences with people. But she really is the reason I'm here in the United States. I met her when I was on my first journey around the world for my book, Eat My Globe, and I fell in love, and I came all the way, you know, as a middle-aged man, I upped sticks from a very comfortable life in England to come and be with her here in Los Angeles. And, you know, I wouldn't have done it for anybody else, and she's absolutely been my reason for being here.
It's wonderful, and it's so charming to hear you talk about her, and in the book too. It just comes through that you guys are such a wonderful couple who obviously love each other very much. Let me ask you, go ahead.
No, we do very much, but she's definitely the boss.
And are you coming through New Jersey? Because I have a beautiful historic home. If you want to come over for dinner, you can cook right in the hearth and we can build a fire.
Oh my gosh. We are. We're trying to add in more dates all the time. We've just added one in, I think, today in D.C. at the Museum of American History has invited me to come and do a talk. So what we're doing is, if people have got somewhere for us to come, and we can go and do, you know, talk and meet with people. And then what's happening and what's really lovely is people are saying, you know, come and stay with us and sleep in our guest rooms or, you know, on a couch or whatever it is. And we love that because, you know, we could stay in hotels very easily. That's not a problem. But there's no connection there. And I think sometimes people are a bit freaked out. They're certainly freaked out about offering to cook for us. So we've not had anybody offer to cook a meal yet. I don't know why, whether they think I'm going to be like, you know, mean or tough on them or something. judge them. But, it's so nice if anyone is ever kind enough to cook a meal. And I'm a great believer that cooking food for someone and sharing your food with someone is one of the highest expressions of love. And so it's something I really, really, really look forward to doing whenever I'm traveling around and just feeding people. It's something my grandparents, my parents did for me, and it's something I'm determined to do as much as I can.
So let me ask you a question. I loved being on the Food Network. I love being on television. I tell anyone who will listen that I want more of that, please. I could be on a set all day long and never get bored, and people around me will drop like flies, and I feel like a Girl Scout. I'm just so excited to be there. My question is about sort of the nature of your level of fame, because I don't know that Alton Brown could pursue the same kind of thing that you can, and I'm wondering if you are balancing anonymity or sort of accessibility, I guess is a better word, with being on a tour and being a public figure.
Well, I always say that I think I have the perfect level of profile, in that I'm well known enough because I'm on a show that's doing very, very well, and I'm lucky enough to be on the Food Network and bask in the shadow of some very, very famous names. So I get people know me, and I get invited to do some really fun stuff, but I'm not famous, so I don't get bothered. Occasionally I'll get a mean email if someone doesn't like the way I judged on Cutthroat Kitchen, or someone will put something rude on Facebook, but that's just par for the course. But I get in, but I can disappear. I can, you know, particularly as I'm bald, I put a hat on and I can disappear into the street and nobody really cares. Whereas I know from spending time with people who are far more well-known than I am, the Michael Simons, Bobby Flays, Alton Browns of this world, that it's harder for them. And it's constant for them. It's relentless. Whereas, you know, I flew back from Puerto Rico yesterday, and at the airport I had, you know, maybe half a dozen people. We changed flights in Atlanta, and I had half a dozen people come up and say they liked the show and have a picture, and then I kind of sat with my wife and got on the plane, you know. But that would be impossible unless they were really hunched up. So I see what it can be like at the other end of that spectrum. So I think I'm in a really nice place, that I get to be asked to do some really fun things. I get to meet terrific people, but I'm not famous, so I don't get any grief at all.
Can I tell you a funny Alton Brown story?
Of course.
Back in the days of Good Eats, when before Cutthroat Kitchen, before real fame set in, he was on a flight. He was probably super famous at the time already, but before I quit my life and ran away to culinary school, he was on a flight out of Atlanta, and we were flying home from Savannah, and my husband pointed out to me that he's like, that's Alton Brown. And our plane was delayed on the tarmac, so I went back to my seat and wrote him a note, and I said, if you ever need an assistant, here's my email, please, please, please call me. And I like got all of my bravery up and gave it back to him, but he never emailed me.
Well, he's I have to say, he's, you know, he, as you can tell with the book Fed White and Blue, Alton wrote the foreword for me, and that meant a great deal, because, you know, I know that's not something he does lightly. And, it was really, I was very touched that he would do that for me.
And he gives you a little ribbing, which I think is obvious, like an indication of your friendship.
Well, we're pals. And, again, I'm very flattered that someone that like that, who I admire so much. And that's the thing, you talk about television, and I always say, look, I work with, and you've met the Cutthroat Kitchen crew, they're just some of the best people you will ever meet.
That
they're the nicest crew, they're just
the
absolutely adorable people, they're like a family to me. And I always say, when even if it's a long day, I go, it's like being in the biggest playpen in the world. You know, I get to sit in my nice judge's trailer. People, make sure I'm looked after. I get to come down and play and watch all the sabotages afterwards. I don't get to know before. And so from that point of view, you know, if I always say to my wife, if I ever complain about a day spent on set, it's too long, just slap me.
Right. The book.
And she would.
The book is Fed White and Blue. Simon Majumdar, thank you so, so much for coming on Sharp and Hot and Heritage Radio Network. It's been an honor to talk to you. I am one of your biggest fans.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, and I really appreciate you letting me tell people about the book.
Of course, and I'm serious about that invitation in New Jersey. I'll get in touch offline.
I will. Do. Absolutely do.
Okay, wonderful. After the break, we're going to come back with Martin Miller's gin president, Jacob Aaron Cronut. We will be right back.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
Welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Simon Majumdar was so sweet, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was pretty awesome.
He was really great. I really am a huge fan of his, and I just really like the guy. I want everybody to go out and read his book. Now, speaking of something that everyone should go out and do.
Yes.
Joining us in the studio is Jacob Aaron Cronut, who is the mastermind behind Martin Miller's Gin. Hi, Jacob.
Hello.
Now, Jacob, I should tell everyone that you and I are friends. We have been out to lunch. You took me to a beautiful lunch at, I'm blanking on the name. What is it? You could say it loud.
I could say it loud.
Jeffrey's.
Right. Jeffrey's. Thank you, in the West Village. We had a great time. And you have introduced me to Martin Miller's gin. And over lunch, you said the most important ingredient in your gin is the water. And I want to start there because I feel like that's something that most gin drinkers don't consider. Everyone talks about the juniper and the aromatics, but you say it's the water.
Yeah, the biggest component and ingredient in most spirits is the water. In Martin Miller's gin, the standard 40% version, we have 60% of the ingredients is the water. And there is often something that is overlooked in the spirit production for very obvious reasons. When you produce spirit, you need the water. Water includes minerals. A standard French bottled water contains around 200 minerals. These need to be removed because over time they would alter the flavor profile of any spirit. And that is obviously not acceptable. So the way around this is to demineralize the water. The Icelanders would say that you kill the water when you take out the minerals. You get a very neutral liquid, which has certain implications on the final product. Whereas the Icelandic water is naturally clean. It's been cleared through the lava mountains in Iceland for around 3,000 years. And when that process is finished, the water that we have today contains zero minerals, but also it's what Icelanders call, it's alive, it has oxygen. And that has some very specific implications on the final product. The number one thing is that you have a surface tension on the Icelandic water, which you don't have in a water which is demineralized. And that makes the nose of the liquid very different, because the botanicals evaporates slowly through the surface tension. So the nose of Martin Miller's gin is very soft bouquet, which you don't have if you use demineralized water. That's why you very often get this very harsh juniper hit if you smell most gins available. On top of that, the mouthfeel is very round because the water contains the oxygen. It's much rounder, so you don't have any harsh afterburn. And that makes Martin Miller's gin quite ideal for any cocktail or even sipping neat.
I have to tell you, it is our new house gin. There's no comparison between other brands. And you said also that the water that you use has never been drank, right?
Yeah, the water in Iceland, you're the first one to drink that water. Most other waters that is being consumed from the municipalities in any major city around the world has been consumed 8 to 16 times.
That is like mind-blowing.
Fascinating.
When I was in third grade, my third grade teacher, Mr. Ackerman, we were studying the dinosaurs, and he was telling us that when you drink a glass of water, a very small droplet of it had passed through a dinosaur. To the third graders, we were like, we're drinking dinosaur pee? And this, like, a day doesn't go by that I don't think about that. But you have now said that the water that comes out of the tap has been consumed by humans 8 or 16 times before it's gotten to me.
Yeah, it's reused, and that's the only way to kind of manage the consumption of water and the way we live today.
And I imagine it's only going to get more so. Like, we're not making any more water.
But it's just, like, not as magical as dinosaur in the water.
Slightly more horrifying. So you take such care, and the water comes directly from Iceland, and you take such care with the selection of that, and that you end up with this product that when we were drinking the cocktails is markedly different from the other gins that are out on the market, and because it doesn't have that like harsh alcoholic burn, and that's because of this process.
Yeah.
So how do you go about selecting your botanicals?
You look each year where do you have the best harvest of the juniper berries or the citrus fruits that you use, and then you go to that area and you pick them.
And how much gin are we talking? Are you producing by volume?
We're doing around, globally annualized, around 200,000 cases.
That's incredible. So how did you get to be the president of the company? Is that the right title? Are you the president?
Yeah, I'm the CEO of the business. The three founders are Martin Miller himself, Andreas Versteeg, and David Bromage, that are very actively
involved. Did they have like thumb wrestling or rock paper scissors to see who they got to name the gin after, or who had the most money? I guess.
No, not at all. It was a very genuine and interesting story how Martin Miller's gin came about. Martin Miller, Andreas, and David were sitting in a bar in Notting Hill in London, and they had a gin and tonic. And the bartender at the time served the gins that were available, lukewarm, a bit of gin tonic, almost flat, asking if they wanted some ice to go with the gin and tonic. And yes, please, that would have been preferred. And maybe some garnish too. A bit of lime was chucked in the glass. And they all looked at this gin and tonic and said, is this really what has happened to the finest white spirits available? And at the time, vodka really dominated the market. And Andreas and David at the time owned Perlstar Vodka, which has now turned into Reykja Vodka. And the three said, let's do the perfect gin money can make. And it wasn't a commercial project at that point. They just simply wanted to make a very good gin. Worst case, they would have to drink it themselves.
Right. That's a pretty good worst case scenario.
Because the idea of going to Iceland to take the water wasn't commercially feasible at the time.
Now, is Martin Miller Icelandic? How did they get to Iceland?
Well, the kind of the innovation of using Icelandic water was brought to Andreas and David because they were producing Pilsner vodka in Iceland.
Okay.
And that's when they learned the unique characteristics of the Icelandic water. Mm. And we've tried to use different kind of waters, but the flavor profile changes. We have not managed to find any water source in the world with the equivalent characteristics.
It's worth, I'll tell you, it is worth it. It is absolutely worth it. I, you were kind enough to send me a bottle after lunch, so thank you, after our lunch a couple of weeks ago. And my husband and my father-in-law, who my father-in-law is a big gin and tonic fan, he was like, this is like really good. So how do we find you? Are you widely available in the stores and the retail market now?
Yeah, we're available across all the states in the U.S. and I would say a majority of any well-stocked liquor store.
And I will tell you that the packaging is also super unique. What are the two flags that are in your logo? There's two intersecting flags.
England, Iceland.
England and Iceland. It has this kind of nautical feel that I really like. I feel like I should be on a catamaran or something, drinking a gin and tonic. This is what I'm going to do when I get to Simon Majumdar level fame. I'm going to try Martin Miller gin and tonics on a catamaran. And so you are pretty specific about your ice also, that the ice can itself can be problematic.
Yeah.
If we're going for the like the pinnacle top perfect gin and tonic.
The ice is of great importance, and it's a very simple mistake that people do, either if they make cocktails or drinks at home or they're being served in a bar. If the ice is not of good quality or they are small, they melt, and that completely ruins the spirit and the mixes that it's blended with. The ice is there to chill, not to dilute. So what you need to use is large chunks of ice, as cold as possible.
How do you feel about the whiskey stones, the rocks that you can freeze that'll stay cold? Then you don't have any water introduced at all.
No, and they just don't give the same quality, I would say, as good ice.
I'm always worried. Mm. We've gotten them as stocking stuffers, and I'm always worried about dropping them into the drink or them like hitting my teeth. I don't know. It makes me feel weird.
Good ice.
So what's your go-to tonic water brand?
Well, we developed Fevertree mixer range back in the days around 2004, 2005 to go with Martin Miller's, because at the time we struggled to find good tonic water, and it varies a lot between different countries. So my personal choice is obviously Fevertree.
Mine too, actually. Yeah. And before I knew that was a revelation over lunch, I was like, you're the Fevertree guy? Because we drink the bitter lemon all the time. Like, it's going out of style.
The ginger ale is very good as well.
Yep. And yes, the ginger ale is great. It has the like the ginger mother in the bottom. I love it. So how, I know that you have a plane to catch, and I'm trying to think if there's anything else, anything that we've missed that you want to bring up. It's Martin Miller's gin. Oh, I know. It comes in a 80 proof and a 100 proof, right?
90 proof.
90 proof.
Yeah.
So what are the difference? If someone's standing in the store and they're looking at the two different bottles, what can they expect the difference to be between the two?
Well, if you're doing more complicated cocktails, I would definitely go for the Westbourne strength. It's stronger, gives a little bit more of a hit, and the flavors comes through the different ingredients of the cocktail. If you're doing a standard gin and tonic, which is my preferred drink, I would go for the 40%.
I loved the 40%. It was really, but I was drinking it as a gin and tonic.
Yeah.
And that bottle, I tell you, it's empty. Yeah. It's very, very drinkable. Thank you so much for coming on Sharp and Hot and Heritage Radio Network. Jacob Aaron Cronut, Martin Miller's Gin is the brand. And can you tell us who we have coming up on next week's show?
I can. We have Andrea Lynn, the author of Queens, A Culinary Passport.
I want to give a shout out. Well, Andrea's a good friend of mine also, so I'm very excited to have her. We got a lot of friends coming on. Let's book my
friends. It's a party.
Some from the Food Network, some my personal friends. I like the balance. I want to give a shout out to listener Evan, who emailed via the Sharp and Hot website or the Facebook page to ask me about what I meant last week when I said analog food. So we had the conversation about truffle oil. He said that he Googled it and he couldn't find anything. And I think I have something to trademark because because no one, I Googled it too. So when I say analog foods, I mean a food that's trying to be something that it's not. So mm-hmm. in my conversation with Evan, I used the expression, vegan cheese right. as an example.
Which is gross.
Which is, you know.
I agree.
It's just not cheese. And no, it needs better PR. It needs a different name. Let's call it something completely unrelated to the dairy industry. And what frustrates me about most analog foods, and you can correct me, Anne, as the resident vegetarian of Sharp and Hot, that you make, and it's and I really take it up with vegan trying to be dairy or vegan trying to be meat. You make this commitment to a particular lifestyle,
right.
and then it's like, but God damn if I don't miss cheese. Let me figure out a way to fix that.
Right.
With cashew butter and agar agar, or cashew milk and agar agar, whatever it is.
Right.
And Evan brought up that he feels like it's the same problem with farmed salmon, that farmed salmon will never be wild salmon.
Right.
And
right.
so they're running into this like ceiling of popularity because anyone who's opposed to farmed salmon is going to be opposed to their products. Whereas if they had better PR and a completely different name, let's call it the Patagonian toothfish or Montauk sea bream is the new name for porgy.
There you go.
Then it's a completely different product and you can relaunch it, so to speak, to people. So that's what I meant. If anyone else was wondering what I meant by analog foods, I thoroughly appreciate right. the feedback. I love hearing from the listeners. Chef Emily at sharpandhot.com, and it is at Chef Emily P on Twitter. Oh, you know what? I should have asked Martin Miller's Gin. Do you guys have a website? You're still sitting here. Hi. You have a website that people can visit?
Yes, martinmillersgin.com.
And it's beautiful, and you have good recipes on it also.
Yes.
I think that's it, right? We got Andrea on next show.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? I have spring fever.
We're just like ready to hang out. We're ready to have a gin and tonic.
I'm ready to have a gin and tonic. All right, everybody, let's not force the issue. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. Until next week, keep playing with fire and knives.
Bye.
Sharp and hot with Chef Family.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.